I think when you get older, it is more important than ever to be able to create long-term relationships, not for the money or, you know, for the prestige, but because you can put your craft to work in a way that actually makes a difference. I've always been very political and I'm very interested in the work done by NGOs. And I think it's very important to support women's rights. And so by having a craft, you can actually go out in the world and you can address some of these issues that matters to you.
My name is Gregers Hering. I am a photographer and guest host of Danish Originals. Our aim is to celebrate Danish creatives who've made a significant mark in the US. Today's guest is Jens Honoré, a Danish photographer. Welcome, Jens.
Thank you very much.
So, Jens, we are meeting virtually here. I'm sitting in Los Angeles. You are in Denmark.
Correct.
Can you first tell the listeners a bit about your setting, where you are, and what it feels like on this evening in Denmark?
I'm currently sitting in my office here in my house in Gentofte, north of Copenhagen, and I'm hoping for some spring soon. The winter has been really long and tough, not only here, but also back in New York, where I'm splitting my time. As I get older, I get light sensitive to the Nordic weather, which is not faring well with me. And that's something that really surprised me when I started spending more time again back in Denmark. The first winter here was brutal. I don't know what to do about it because it doesn't get any better. Mm-hmm. It's lighter in New York, but this winter has been very cold in New York as well.
Yeah, I was just about to say the weather on the East Coast in the US is not too different from what we're used to in Denmark.
Correct.
But still you feel a difference in the light and the vibe of wintertime in Denmark compared to the East Coast. Can you talk a little bit about how they make you feel differently?
The climate in New York is very steady. So when it's winter, it's cold with snow. We had snow every year. When it's summer, it's actually brutally hot. But I like the seasons. That's something I really thrive on. And since I'm from Denmark, I grew up with seasons and I really appreciate that also as a photographer. I love the fall. It's kind of my favorite season. And being in New York or New England is fantastic, even though I'm not a nature photographer. I like to use my camera as a tool to get out in nature. And sometimes I take some photos. Never use them for anything, really. I had a few assignments over the years, but I'm not that kind of photographer. So that is something I couldn't live without. But then spending more time here, especially in the wintertime, has been brutal. And I forgot about it, you know, all the years I was in the United States because we never went home for Christmas. I don't know what to do because you think when you get older, you get more used to things, but it's the opposite. I think it's harder, you know, by the years. So that's how it is, right?
Do you think it's not only about the temperature and the darkness? Would you say that there's different energies in these two places that affect you as well?
That's an excellent question. For sure I do. I mean, the 22 years I had a company in the United States, it's given me an energy about not only New York, but the country as a whole, which is quite different from Denmark. And it's very hard to compare United States to Denmark because Denmark is more like Long Island, not even New York State. And taking the whole country, which I've been traveling for years and have been in most states, is quite different. Something that is making the winter a little longer and harder to survive here in Denmark is that people in Denmark are very officious. If you don't know what to do, don't do it here. And you feel in the supermarket when you wait in line and you don't have your money ready and stuff like that. And that is something I really like about the United States, that it's more, at least it used to be that way. You have space to be whoever you want to be. Where in Denmark, I mean, Copenhagen's a little different. Where I'm from, Sønderborg, which is in the southern part of Jutland. I mean, the way people are, even though now I started to go back every summer, I go back to something called Ringriden, which is like a big kind of festivitas that take place in Schleswig-Holstein. Mm-hmm. From, you know, back when Denmark and Germany was very intertwined, they still are. And when I come back there, and even though it's more than 40 years since I moved away from Sønderborg, it's just under my skin. And you have that saying that you can take me out of Sønderborg, but you cannot take Sønderborg out of me. And
yeah,
it's not a bad thing. And I'm not trying to discourage my background or anything, but there's a reason why 5 days after I graduated high school, I was leaving town, also because I wanted to do something you couldn't do there. So that's a very, very good question. And I think that moving to Copenhagen as a relatively young photographer, and that's where I started my own business back in 95, it was a more international feeling even though the city has really changed a lot since. Mm-hmm. But I like that roominess you get in the United States. I like that.
Yeah. And we're going to go back to your journey, how you started, how you got here in a minute. But I want to stay with this topic for just a few more minutes because I think it's very interesting. Now, do you also sense that you are attracted to different things with your camera, at least for your personal work, when you are in Denmark compared to when you are in the States? Do you feel you're pointing your lens differently in these two places? And I'm not thinking about assignments. I'm thinking about your natural instincts.
Yeah. Excellent question. That is spot on. I remember when I moved to the United States, the first 2 years I was there, I took really shitty photos, but I thought they were fantastic. At that time, I'd already been to the United States many times and worked there a lot. But moving there and bringing your family and all that and buying a house and really being as American as you can. I was so intrigued living there. I was running around photographing and I was attracted to these lonely spaces, the parking lots, the shopping malls. And then I look at photos today. Yeah, that's a very common if you grew up in America. And I got the same sense when I'm back in Denmark. I don't take that many photos, less and less, unfortunately. And that is on my list to bring a camera out and start taking more photos because I always work on big projects and book publishing. And sometimes I need to get back to how I used to be as a teenager, running with my camera and shooting all kinds of stuff. And it's harder for many reasons. One of the things that makes it harder is because I feel I know Denmark so well, so why would I photograph it? I travel a lot, and I've been to many, many different countries, very foreign to both America and Denmark. So I had my lust covered in that sense. For 25 years, I traveled 150 days a year. So for me to come home, I didn't have that need. I had other needs. I'm a very social person. I'm a very outgoing person. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a wine guy. I'm a tennis guy. I have a lot on my plate. But over the years, I am more attracted to solitude, and that's what I like about photography. It's a very one-man show. I mean, of course, when I'm on big sets and doing big advertising campaigns, it's a lot of people. But if you get back to the roots about why I get into it, I like that thing that is just you and your camera. And then there's a certain instant gratification coming home. I mean, I'm from the analog period, so coming home and developing film and see the result. And I'm really trying to do that again. I actually brought out some of my old 4x5-inch technical cameras on my medium-sized cameras and shooting on films. And actually, two of the books I've done recently has been photographed analog. And it really gave me another dimension I missed in my photography without actually knowing what it was.
I can personally very much relate to what you're talking about coming home to Denmark. It's actually the place I find the hardest to get a sense of what I want to photograph or what I want to go out and do. But as soon as you're out, things happen. If we imagine that you would go out tomorrow or drive somewhere in Denmark, do you think it would be landscapes or people you would immediately try to find that feeling that you're talking about that you felt back when you started?
I'll definitely go back to nature. I mean, my work is 90% people. It's all based on very concrete things. I'm not a street photographer. I'm not a press photographer. So if I venture out to meet people, it serves a purpose, which I like. I can't do that in all I do, but I like to create a vision before I start a project. I'm very attracted to the west coast of Denmark in Jutland. Mm-hmm. And I actually started a project with no goal in sight for my own kind of sanity. It's going really well. I don't know where to go with it, but I've been photographing fish or sea creatures.
Okay, great.
On an earlier project, I made a book called Alles Ret, The Right to Food, which was food for homeless people. And it was created by the chef, Rasmus Munk. Mm-hmm. And I asked, you know, where do you get your fish? I mean, all these Michelin star restaurants you find, especially in Copenhagen. And they came up with this place out in Rødovre. And everybody from Denmark know that Rødovre is not a very photogenic place. But they are the only place that actually sell high quality fish, but it also fish in a sustainable way. That really speaks volume to me. I've been photographing on a 4x5 technical camera with cheat film. It's an old technique. You probably know that, Gregers, before you had Photoshop. If you photograph things that was free flowing, you used a glass plate. Uh-huh. Remember that? And then you had to backlight it so you couldn't tell the shadows and stuff like that. So it's also for me to challenge myself photographing in a way that I was very used to beforehand. And just because I think I know how to do it doesn't mean I'm good at it. It's like if you used to be a good badminton player and then you haven't played for 20 years, you go out and you're not that good anymore.
Yeah.
So it's been an uphill battle. I want to use that word because it really was. And then also getting into the dark room, I had an assistant working for me. So I haven't been in the dark room myself, which is super rewarding because you can spend, you know, half a day making one or two good prints and getting into buying the right paper. And that's something I'm spending a lot of time on, also because I have the time for it. Even though it sounds, wow, you're so holistic in your approach to photography. I'm not, because I'm so used to being hired and you only pick up the phone if it's an assignment and you go out and you do it and then you don't do it. And so I try to go back. I mean, when you get older, it's not linear, it's circular. And I circle back to when I became a photographer.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you also for your honesty. It never becomes predictable, right? Photography. You think you can go out and do something, it will turn out a certain way. And then there's a learning process to everything.
And it's funny to talk about because photography is a craft, right? Mm-hmm. So craftsmanship you learn. And once you've done that process of going from driving the go-kart to drive Formula One, now you have the craftsmanship to lean back on or lean into, and you can create whatever vision you want. So if you want to photograph on this specific camera using that film, it's a great, great feeling. I give talks to younger photographers, and sometimes I see only having the digital camera is fantastic and Photoshop is fantastic, but it's also a limitation in the way you can express yourself. I love photography. It's very tangible. But then at the same time, it's not that tangible because it can go in all directions. And to challenge your craft constantly is something that keeps me passionate about what I do.
Yeah. The urge to photograph, that powerful feeling inside, this fire that sometimes it burns brighter, sometimes burns more subtle. It's always there, I presume. What is that urge at this point in your life and career compared to when you started out?
Wow, that's a long span. I'm from a place in Denmark where you tread carefully and all that kind of stuff. And it's a big part of my personality, even though it doesn't seem that way. If you want to go out and do something, you need to know what you're doing. And that's why I think it took me a number of years to venture out to start my own business. I mean, I did all kinds of catalog photography. I needed those smiles in my legs, so to speak. And I needed to show to myself that I had that confidence to go out and sell myself. One thing is salesmanship, and we all know that. But I don't want to be a used car sales guy. Mm-hmm. I want to have something that is solid. And the two things go hand in hand. I think you can be a nice person and you can approach people with the right desire. But what is paramount to me is that the result really speaks for itself. I'm not a filmmaker in any stretch, but I've been working on a small documentary for a number of years with this old artist couple in upstate New York, up in Hudson Valley. It's called The Crosses, about not how well they did as artists, how well they sold, or how much the piece went for. It's that the journey is the destination. I think when you get older, it is more important than ever to be able to create long-term relationships, not for the money or, you know, for the prestige, but because you can put your craft to work in a way that actually makes a difference. So, for instance, I've never been a fashion photographer. I'm from Sunnagård. I don't know what fashion is. I've always been very political, and I'm very interested in the work done by NGOs, and I think it's very important to support women's rights. And so by having a craft, you can actually go out in the world and you can address some of these issues that matters to you, and you can address them to some of these organizations, which I did many years ago, and say, you know, I have this idea about how to improve your brand in a certain way, and this is my approach, blah, blah, blah. And that's been a fantastic thing, to be able to make a good living on what you do, but at the same time also being able to allow yourself to do those things without having a goal. It's all about the money, because I mean, all the people I went to school with and all the people who used to have a huge studio in Copenhagen, there's nobody left in the business. I don't and you know all about that, Gregers, right? But I mean, the cannibalism within our business has been severe. And I think it's important that you stay true to yourself. I've just been lucky. My photography is very analog and it's very based on photographing real people and read the room and understand who you're working with. And I see that's one of the few fields still left. I mean, you look at all the other fields, you know, I have had agents for years and all the people I used to work with. I mean, car photography is gone. still life, even fashion. The other day, I met a guy who told me some kind of fast fashion brand just did the first AI campaign.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa. So, yeah.
But just to finalize this part of the conversation, if you look away from the business and clients for 6 months, do you still need to create something that is tangible, like a print or connect or experience the world through the lens of a camera?
Whoa. That's a tough one. Yeah. I've contemplated doing other things. And actually, the funny thing on your LinkedIn page, you call yourself a storyteller. I had gone back to photography because it is as simple as it is. And yeah, with that, you can add on a lot of things. My foundation is that I don't have a plan B. I'm a very emotional person, actually, somewhere in there. My photography is one of the tools to keep me sane. So my photography is not driven by email. I mean, I love to get jobs, and when my agent's calling up with jobs and all that, don't get me wrong, but it's all based on my work, and I still have an urge to reach out to people where I think I can make a difference and I can improve the brand, so to speak. And when you're putting yourself out there, often you have the serendipity of meeting people who somehow understand what you're trying to do and see the realness in your work. And I love that. And if you're just sitting home and think, oh, I'm so accomplished and I've done all this and I published this book and I know this person, then maybe you should start thinking about other things. But I think that my field, or our field, is a great gateway to do all kinds of interesting things I'm really passionate about.
Yeah.
So if you pull that plug, I think all the other things will come crashing down.
Yeah. Your work is indeed very people-driven. Your advertising, corporate work, also your personal projects, which we'll speak about in a minute. Let me ask you this overall question. When you are hired, or you do it out of free will, to photograph a person, what is it you're trying to see or get them to see? What are you going for?
Well, I don't think there's a certain recipe. When I meet somebody you know from the public, but you don't know them in person, I, of course, do my homework. I really believe in homework. I think pre-production is as important as post-production. I've worked with Roger Federer for 10 years now. And not his tennis part. I did Match in Africa, which also made money for his foundation. But it's traveling around in Africa. And it's a very broad-sided kind of assignment because, I mean, he's not only a tennis player. He's a global superstar, still is, and he's bigger than ever. And I know him now, and I'm the only non-Swiss guy on the team. You never know, right? And I know many celebrities and photograph many of them, but he is the real deal. So what you do, you try to read the room. I hate that expression, but you try to sit back a little bit in the beginning and just feel the atmosphere. Also, it's not only about the person, if it's that level, it's all the surroundings. Mm. And especially in America, as we both know so well, agents and assistants, and it can become very hysterical in a bad way. And my photography is quite simple. It doesn't take a lot of lighting and all that. All the stuff you see with Roger is done with daylight. And it looks super easy, but that is the most difficult thing to do. And that's why you need to know your craft, because I cannot run around with flashlights and stuff when he's interacting with children. And we go to Malawi, where they don't see many Caucasian people, and especially the camera. So if I came in with a camera and lighting, I could not get these candid moments that is so important for the foundation to show that Roger Ferrer is just a name. He's actually caring about the children they're trying to help. And then on top of that, you have all the presidents and the royal families and parliament members who also want to be photographed with Roger. And I do that, and it's not easy peasy, but it is what it is.
Yeah, Roger Federer being the legend, how did you get that gig? How did that happen?
It's quite a funny story. I addressed him back in, I think, 2011. That was a number of years after I'd done my first book about Africa. And I was so intrigued by that whole thing. And back then, I already started to work with an OSHA organization called SOS Children's Villages, which support children in need and women's rights. And I'm a huge tennis fan. That's the only sport I can really follow closely. Then I spoke to his father, super nice guy. Back then, it was a small organization. It was a smaller foundation. And he was still the number one tennis player in the world. And he actually stayed there for a long time. And then out of nowhere, I got an email that the normal guy that had in there couldn't come to a trip if Roger qualified for the Wimbledon final. And I was actually back in Denmark in my summer house in Rømø. And I got this call, like, what? Who? Where? It was surreal. And I had a long talk with the CEO of the foundation, really nice woman, super clever at what she does, and just was very much on par with what I wanted to do with him. She really got my vision. And I guess that's what she saw in my photographs. And that's what I really like. And same with what you do with advertising campaigns. And I love when people actually understand what is this ability to enhance our brand in a visual way. I flew to Geneva and then we joined the airplane. He was just like any other guy. Back then, he was still sponsored by Nike. And I didn't want it to look like commercial. The first thing we did when we came to Malawi, I said, can we turn down the logos and stuff? And he was like, yeah. And he was just, thank you very much for having me. No, thank you very much for coming. Like, well, when you meet really top people, they don't need to tell you. I mean, the mid-level guy who's bumping against the glass ceiling, he's the worst guy to photograph. He's telling you, you know, I think we're done now. And, you know, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
And then also to understand who you're dealing with and understand when to pull back. When you travel like that, when you're together 24/7, you cannot only be the photographer with him sitting talking tennis for hours in a car. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Consider, it's not a friend, but at least now we know each other and I met his family and all that. And he's really, really nice guy. He's the real deal.
You have very strong, humanely driven projects. And one of them is the right to food. Can you talk briefly about what that is about?
Yeah, I started spending more time in Denmark and I've worked a lot of social projects in the United States as well. And as we have that duality now by having, you know, both citizenship in Denmark and the United States, you can really compare. And that's one of the things where you can compare. The social network in Denmark is fantastic. I mean, and the social welfare program is really working well. Your tax money is put to work in a much, much better way than at least in New York. I was intrigued to find out that because of technicalities and nonsense and silly stuff, you had a group that grew significantly since I moved to the United States. And these were people who somehow fell through the cracks, mostly drug addicts, people who didn't fill out the paperwork, so you're not eligible to get social welfare and stuff like that. And what happens was that some of these people, first of all, they didn't have a place to live, but they didn't get anything to eat. And you know, as well as I do, if you give a drug addict money, they don't go and buy a sandwich. They use it for more drugs. They're always chasing that next high.
Yeah.
And then Rasmus Munk had his kitchen closed during COVID. And he worked with the, I don't know what's called in English, lawyers who work for free. And they walk around and talk to homeless people to make sure that are they okay? Because living on the fringe of society in that way is a nightmare.
Yeah. And Jens, sorry to interrupt you, but just briefly explain to us who Rasmus Munk is.
Yeah, Rasmus Munk is the main chef and founder of Alchemist, which is deemed one of the best restaurants in the world. We're talking about super level, high-end chef.
We're talking about Noma level here, top of the pop.
Oh yeah. But Rasmus is from Randers. And when he saw that, he said, I want to make a difference. And I still know how to make mashed potatoes, meatballs. So they decided, why not reach out to all the collaboration we have with different food stores and even scale it up and talk to supermarket chains and selling group and FDB and say, do you have any surplus of food that's not expired, but the shelf life has come to a date so you cannot sell it anymore? We can take that in. And he spent a lot of time finding out how can you make food for people who have maybe only a meal a day, they have bad teeth, bad digestion. So it's very solid food, a lot of cream, because they need calories, especially in the wintertime. And that's how they started. And they started down in Kødbyen in Copenhagen, where you have user rooms for drug addicts when you're fixing or you're smoking, whatever you take. They serve food there. And so I cold emailed Rasmus, and this guy gets like 100 emails a day. Yeah. And I had this vision to create a program about what food means, because food is the most conflict-limiting process you can do to people. And I've learned that from all my years traveling the world. You can build all the schools you want and all the whatever. If children don't get anything to eat, they don't learn anything. If you can feed them, you are minimizing conflicts and the learning abilities tremendously. It's very cheap and it's one of the best tools. And I think to me, food is a very democratic thing. Everybody should eat.
Yeah.
In the United States, we throw away 35% of our food and we still have massive amount of people on food stamps and SNAP programs, and that's ridiculous. That's where it comes from. These are people who have sacrificed everything because of their drug addiction. Wanted to take the photograph in a way that was timeless, and I wanted it to be about food. It was kind of vox pop kind of questionnaire where I was cut out, of course, the editing, and then I asked people the same question. We set up a studio. We didn't have any guarantee that anybody would show up. But many of them came just after they were using whatever they're using. And they came into my little studio, you know, I had set up down there. Yeah. At age 17, it's called Helmtorvet, which is this place for drug addicts. And I only took 3 cassettes of each person, 3 films of each person, which is this black and white thing. And I did the whole lift printing and all that. It's too technical to get into here. But I really wanted to do something to honor people and pay tribute to what Rasmus is doing. And I also want to respect people, because everybody they meet is just criticizing them for what they do.
Yeah, I should tell the listeners that it's a series of portraits in black and white, and each photographed person has a sound sample where they talk about their relationship with and right to food. It is very moving. I think these portraits are incredibly strong. How did you build that intimacy in that little studio, and how did you get their trust and get them to open up to you in these amazing photos?
First of all, I didn't talk to them as people who were destroying their life with drugs. They came with another purpose. It was an inviting place. We made it clear what I was trying to do. Actually, the first day, nobody showed up. The next day, one showed up. He went out on the ramp outside and told people he's actually a nice guy. And we talk about food and put a cloth over his head. And he has this funny camera, you remember, from the old Western. The third day, 4 people came in. And then the fourth day, I mean, we just had to turn people down and wait in line and stuff like that. It was crazy. And then by having these same questions, I knew I wanted to talk to the people. And I had an assistant with professional audio, so we recorded everything in high quality. And once we were done, we came out with these tremendously interesting stories. I mean, we were just having a blast. And really in a good way, because they came back to places where they didn't live the life they do today. That one Christmas meal they had with a father who was absent most of their life and stuff like that. And the stories, Gregus, we heard in there, how they came to where they are today and their family background. I mean, I've seen a lot of things in my life, but it was really tough. You cannot plan this. I kind of like that because I'm a control freak. But I knew I could get the photos at least. But then the audio came on top of that, and then you could make a video. And then we made an exhibition that had a lot of fuss about it and the newspaper, and we were on TV and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly we can make a book as well. And that book, we just went all in. Everybody worked for free. It's the most beautiful book I'll give you next time we're together. It's really high-end print. It won a lot of prizes as well. And to emphasize that we care about you. We know how fragile you are. Yeah. And then by having their own voices talking about food, it was just a gift. Keep on giving. Yeah.
Yeah. Very strong work.
And one last thing. So we decided to photograph the food because it is about food. You know, back then they made 400 portions a day, and it's not very photogenic to photograph a meatball and as potatoes. So what I did, I used all different kind of produce, and I photographed it the exact same way as I photographed the people, just, you know, with daylight coming from one side and with the same camera, with the same film, to give it that feel. So you break up the book. Instead of having all the portraits just coming in a long row, you have sometimes a photograph of onions or potatoes and stuff like that.
Yeah. For the subjects you photographed, were they ever interested in seeing the picture? Did you promise them a print afterwards? Or was that part not the most important thing to them and more the experience of being photographed?
I mean, we had some of them showing up for the big opening and also for the book launch. But really, no, for them, it was just a small room of liberty of not thinking about who they are and the life they're living, but having comfort of sitting there with somebody who don't know them and don't judge them by what they do, and just talk about happy moments in their life. I mean, the background of those people are just devastating to listen to, but they have those kind of brief moments of happiness, and those were the ones we were trying to emphasize here.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. What does it mean to you, and why is it important to do these socially conscious projects next to your advertising work and your branding work?
I try to make coherent work that is connected to each other, whether it's paid or not paid. I get paid by Roger Federer, but all the work I did for SOS Children's Villages, it's free. It's my donation, because I don't have that kind of money to make a dent here, but I can make an impact using my craft. And that's what you see in the book, A Place to Dream, which is actually made over 12 years. And talking about pre-production, that you have something that you know how to do, and you cannot tell in the book which photo is 12 years old and which is brand new. I work a lot in pharmaceuticals, and you know, back in the days when you have a doctor on a white background saying, take this pill and you'll feel better. That train left the station many years ago. And a great gift for me is to work with these pharmaceutical companies to tell a story about how they produce the medicine that can be a part of the solution. I work a lot with mental diseases, what you call brain diseases today. And it's super interesting to go around the world photographing people and telling that if you take this medicine, it can be a part of the solution together with a great diet and exercise and all that, because there's a lot of stigma still connected to being depressed. Yeah. And it's all based on meeting real patients. And many times I meet people, I don't even speak the language. So I need a really good translator. And that's something I spend time on. I work with AIDS medicine, with Merck. What I've done there, I always was part of the casting process, because these were real people who contracted HIV in all the different ways you can contract that illness. And that's also a lot of stigma attached to that illness, how people are deemed a certain way if they live a certain way. That was important for me to get people to understand that we are here to honor them. And that medicine you're getting is a part of the solution to have an improved quality of life. Uh-huh. The biggest part of my job is not the technique. I spend most of the time calming down the patient. And if you can keep the set as simple as possible, it makes it even better. Because sometimes I take the chance to say, can we do this just with daylight on just one simple lamp instead of having all, you know, the stuff, especially when you work with children.
Yeah. You were mentioning the book, what was it called? A Place to Dream?
A Place to Dream, yeah.
Can you talk briefly about that?
It's a body of work that is done in collaboration with SOS Children's Villages. And it came up after all the years I've been working with them, which I still do sometimes. And we decided, could we make something for the bigger donors? I mean, today, NGOs rely more and more on wealthy families or companies that give them money. And SOS is more than 1 billion euro budget a year. It's the biggest in that field. How do you address that? How do you tell people what we do actually matters? I came up with that idea. Could we find the money to do a really high-end book and give out to these mega donors? And that's how the book came up. And it's based on some 2030 goals in the UN in the different fields related to the work they do. The things they're dealing with is global.
Yeah.
That's how it came around.
Okay. All right. Let's backtrack. Do you remember what inspired you as a young man to do photography?
Wow. I was in, you have that Erwerbspraktik, what did you call it in English?
Yeah, it's an opportunity to get, I guess, an unpaid job while you are still in...
In school.
In school. Yeah.
In middle school. And you get a week off to go to a place. And I actually chose to be with a photographer. Yeah. And that was just a fantastic week.
Who was the photographer?
It was a photographer back in Sønderborg. That's also where I took my practical part of my education. He's retired now. Back then, you had photographers in every town in Denmark. Yeah. And it was Danfoss and Linak, two huge companies based back there. So a lot of industrial photography and all that. Yeah. I liked the independence of being in charge of a camera and capture whatever you want to capture.
Yeah,
that's what really stayed with me. We were only five guys back in Sønderborg who went there. It was not a common thing as it is today among young people. And then I started university in Aarhus to study economics. And because of my background, I talked about earlier about tread carefully and all that. I had that internal battle. I want to do that. But at the same time, I couldn't picture myself running my own business. And the whole thing about not having a steady income was scary when you were 18, 19.
Yeah.
I took a year off in university. I moved to Spain and I really photographed a lot and got more into it. And then I was lucky enough to get into the school. And it takes 4.5 years to become a photographer. Don't ask me why, but it does. And I'm very happy I did that because it fits my personality about once you started something, you're going to complete it. And then I can also postpone that whole fear about becoming self-employed one day. And then I took another 3 or 4 years working with catalogs with other photographers.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You spent time in Copenhagen, and aside from your travel to Spain, when did it occur to you that Denmark was, I don't know if it's the right wording, becoming too small? You had bigger dreams. You wanted to get out in the big world. Where did the journey take you from there?
I was at a place called Sjælland, which was the biggest place that ever existed in Denmark. And back then, you know, advertising business was big. We had Saatchi and McCann, Gray, and so on. My business really took off and I had people work for me and I was photographing 200 days a year and it was fantastic. But I also came to a point where I remember, and I was like, whoa, 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 is that what you want? several times in my life, I had to back off a little bit and say, why did you become a photographer? And I was forgetting myself and I was always stressed. I remember when I was driving back to my house in Charlottenlund from my studio in Nørrebro, I mean, my cell phone couldn't leave more messages. At the same time, it was also a time where, you know, I bought a bigger car next time. I bought a new car, a big wine cellar. It's embarrassing to talk about.
Yeah.
I got the bug and then suddenly I didn't have it at all. And I was lucky to start having jobs in the United States. In the beginning, I worked a lot in Miami. I loved the difference between Copenhagen and Miami. Miami is very Latin, warm. There was a certain freedom I just enjoyed. And then, of course, the pay for the jobs was much better in Denmark, even though we were at the top in Denmark, which is not normal for a guy from Sønderborg to say, oh, I had a great business. But I kept on having that urge to make more of my own projects. I kept on saying, I need to do more of this. But then I talk about that serendipity of meeting the right people. You also had to put yourself out there, which you can't if you're always busy and running around doing commercial jobs. So I was this catch 22. I love to photograph, but also did it in a way that it felt a little off to me after a while. After that success settled with me and I saw, oh, you can make it and all that, I was just like, let's stay true to yourself. Do you dare do that? And then more and more jobs in America. Actually, when we decided to move there full time, because I was back and forth all the time. It was crazy times. We intended to move to Miami in the beginning because that's where all the jobs were. And I had some really good friends there. I worked with a Danish art director down there. And we were just great pals and still are. And then also I did a lot of job out in Phoenix. And so why not Phoenix? But then I got my first agent. She was based out of New York. And she's like, what are you doing down here? Look at your work. If you want to work with me and you want to pursue what you really love, we have to go this way. And you have to put in the work and the time to get there. Yeah. And so I would love you to be in New York. And, you know, back then you had a portfolio to show up at meetings. Yeah. And with my name and my accent, being in New York was like, whoa, thank you very much for coming here. And then spending more and more time in New York and starting getting the first jobs. And so New York, it became. And then we took the whole family and moved over there. Yeah.
And how many years did you end up spending full-time living in New York before you decided to move back to Denmark? And what was the tipping point for you and your family to decide to move back to Denmark?
I was there for 15 years. My children was 1 and 3 years old when we moved there. It was a lot of work. And we could have been back in Denmark after a year if it didn't work out. And it worked out. And 1 year became 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, and so on. We never had any plans, but we always said to ourselves that one day we would return to Denmark to introduce our daughters to Denmark. When Trump became president the first time,
yeah,
it was devastating. There were many breaking points. I mean, I work with women, I have a wife, and I have two daughters.
Yeah.
And when the right to abortion went from a federal thing back to the States,
yeah,
I understand the frustration because you only have two parties in America. And if you live in New York, as I did, I have a place there on Long Island, you know, the amount of taxes you pay is quite similar to Denmark, but you don't get anything for your tax money. So I understand why people are dissatisfied and this renegade guy comes around, a TV star or whatever he was, and then he becomes a president and now it's a cult. And it's so sad to see what's going on with America right now. People don't realize how much it's hurting the country and how much it's hurting the soft power America had. I see it in Africa and in third world countries around the world that US aid has just disappeared. I'm really concerned because I think democracy as we see today is in tremendous pressure. We're not going the right direction. And today, even though we have some rotten apples within EU, EU is really standing up to something. We lost Great Britain to Brexit, which is also one of these protest votes. And that's the way I see Donald Trump, the protest vote, because people are so unsatisfied. I don't know how to solve that, but there's some fundamental problems the United States is facing with private healthcare, education, and then the two-party system. That concerns me a lot. And I don't know how to translate that into my photography, but I'm a very conscious photographer. And I think if you can make it a story that plays to dream in all my NGO work, I can make a difference and not just give up on the world. And I think that's important to stay sane that way, because just look what's going on now. Yeah. Everything is very hysterical. And I think it's very interesting times.
For sure. Yeah. I know you're still spending a lot of time here, but for your family, how has the transition been going back to being in Denmark, especially your daughters that have grown up here?
It was uphill. Also with the language and writing abilities. I mean, especially the youngest one, she's spoke English many years before she started speaking Danish. And she only learned it by us, you know, persisting.
Yeah.
She's doing well now. And the oldest one, she lives in England to finish her education there. Let me put it this way. My wife is super happy to be back. I have had a hard time, and that is, you know, an ongoing crisis for me because I love America. But at the same time, if you start getting to the comparison thing, it's hard to do because Denmark beats America in any sense. I mean, the wealth and the way Denmark has been faring since I moved there to coming back, it's just been a success story. I mean, are we old enough to remember how Denmark was back in the 80s? Is, oh wow, is this the same country? And it reinforced my passion about staying vocal about the things that matters to you. And I think Denmark's a very good example on that, that you can have a democracy and you can have differences in politics without getting into a fight. I mean, my local tennis club in Northport, Long Island, you know, we have guys who've been a member of the club for 50 years. They don't talk to each other anymore because one voted for Trump and the other voted for Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted. We just had election in Denmark and there was 12 parties. And this is getting back to voting in Denmark. It's like, whoa, at least there's some consensus. You have a certain right to being looked upon and treated no matter, you know, your income and your background. And that is something you have to value a lot. And it's not a given anymore. Yeah. Look what's going on in America.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Are you worried about photography as we know it in the future?
That's a good question. Wow. I would say the easy answer is yes. I think we're making the same mistake with AI as we did with the smartphone back in 2008.
Yeah.
Now the genie is out the bottle. You can't put it back there. I'm not so concerned about the craft itself because I think it will find a level. Since I'm on that shelf, I feel pretty confident about the work I do.
Yeah.
But I think the whole thing about now you can come up with photos and videos where everything is artificial. How do you approve anything anymore? And especially, I mean, I read the New York Times and I actually also read Fox News. I don't know why I do it, but I do. And if you look at those two entities, it's two different countries.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it's important to follow both.
Yeah. And it's such a broken system. I've seen around the world. I've seen how China, I worked in China over the years since I started coming there to now. I, as a photographer, had to go down to get a visa to be interviewed by two officers. If they're not sure that I don't want to take photos that somehow harm China. Have you looked at my website? Yeah. It's blocked in China. It's not political at all. So I'm concerned we have a war two countries down here, Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
And like, okay, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
And everything becomes so black and white. So I think if you want to convey any message you have, you can just sit on a computer now and call yourself a photographer and you can come up with all kinds of, I mean, photography can tell a story, which is fantastic. Yeah. But when you get into the new circles and you find photos that is made like fiction, I think it harms the whole business. And I don't know how to push back against it because you cannot. Then the whole thing about everybody's photographer today, if you look at the new iPhones, I mean, I met a guy who's very big into AI. He told me the new Samsung phone already has AI built into it. So you have to go into the settings and I don't know how you stop making AI photos. If you want to take a photo of a sunset in the old days, you had to make three different exposure. So it's not only the sun and everything is black. It does that. The same with photographing people. It enhances the features you like, wrinkles to take away and bigger eyes and stuff like that. And something that really concerns me is mental health. And I think that we have a lot of young people who are not faring well. And now you create an even more perfect world that doesn't exist out there. Come on. And I think we need some kind of world society to step up, like food security. That's my wife working that business. I mean, all the shit you can buy in America, they put a ban on that in Europe and EU with the same products. So it is possible to go out there. But since we have a president of the most powerful country in the world that think that UN is a joke, NATO is a joke, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that sometimes you need to helicopter off and have a bigger subject about how can we push back in a way, but also understand.
Yeah.
Don't be an ostrich. Face the problems. If I can, you know, make the world a better place, I know it sounds so Sebastian-like from the 70s, but I really believe in that.
Yeah.
I believe in togetherness. I believe in collaborations. I believe that you can use your craft in all kinds of interesting ways. I've been working on a project called Handwerk zum Lebenswerk. It's about craftsmanship because I think that the purposeful life is going to be a big struggle for this generation coming up. I think that craftsmanship is something that you can keep on evolving. And I found 15 people I photographed in Denmark who all live in different locations within the country. And they do all kinds of different things. Yeah. And hopefully we can find money for it, but it'll be published on GED.
Yeah.
Later this year. And that's something I'm super excited about.
That's an excellent idea.
I use myself as an example. When people listen to me, I'm 60 years old. And they're like, what? You're still working as a photographer? You know, it's that whole thing about using yourself as an example and you have skin in the game. I think it's important.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Good old Sebastian, a fellow Sønderborgian.
That is correct.
Okay, last question, Jens. If you got the opportunity tomorrow to photograph a person, who would you want to photograph? Is there someone out there that you are dying to photograph?
Oh, you put me on the spot here. I think we lost a lot of these iconic people, and then you find out there were a history of darkness. But I was lucky to photograph Desmond Tutu.
Okay.
That was surreal. Because he was so nice and you felt like you were 12 years old. And I'm not a religious person in any means, but you know, you had to do a prayer and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
If you look at my website, I was lucky to work with a foreign minister. I've been his photographer on and off for 25 years. He used to be the prime minister of Denmark.
I did see the pictures of Lars Løkke, and I presume most of the listeners know who he is.
The man who saved Denmark, as we call him here.
Yeah, exactly. Most recently being involved in the negotiations about Greenland. He's a very experienced and known politician in Denmark. And the pictures you've made of him are brilliant. Okay, great, Jens. As I said, we could keep on talking, but thank you so much for spending the time with us. I will be in Denmark soon, so I would love to meet up and see you.
Okay, nice. I made a book about wine, so we can easily open a bottle of wine and we can keep on talking.
Yes.
Thank you very much for having me on. Those were excellent questions, Gregers. They really were.
Thank you. Thank you for being so honest. For today's episode, Jens Honoré chose Jesper Rasmussen's Dumbo, Brooklyn, New York from 2005 from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark.
I have chosen a piece by Jesper Rasmussen, and the title of the photo is Dumbo, Brooklyn, New York. I'm always happy to see my field, photography, used as an art form. This photograph, it's very strong, it's very tangible, and it speaks to me because it's so lonely. In a city like New York, with all the famous buildings and landmarks, and then you find old buildings like this warehouse, it also tells a story about a different city where not that long ago, blue-collar industry was a very important part of the fabric of the city. And what I love about it is it's all function and absolutely no form. So it's not beautiful. And to make it even more brutal, there's no windows and doors in the building. The few windows you can see, not that there's many windows in a warehouse, it's been blinded. I was curious about that, so I took the liberty to call up Jesper. And he told me this piece is a part of a bigger series of photographs called Off Location. So all the photos in post-production, he removed windows and doors. And it enhances this feeling of something that is lonely and abandoned. When I started coming to America as a young photographer, these were the things I photographed. And I have many, many, many photos and images of factories, warehouses, parking lots and stuff like that.
You've been listening to Danish Originals, podcast series that spotlights Danes who have made a significant impact in the U.S. in the areas of creativity, originality, and innovation. The series is directed by Christian D. Brun and hosted by Tina Yun Christensen, along with Gregers Herring, Asker Hussein, Finolf Jones, Nikolai Rotbol, and Carsten Solchuk Shack. It is produced by Teresa Lai, mastered by Sean Hedinger and Greg Williams, with original music by Joachim Swarm and executive produced by Christian D. Brun and Tina Yun Christensen. We invite you to subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to share it with others, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review that will encourage others to listen. To stay in touch, you can also find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Danish Originals is a fiscally sponsored project of Nordic Concepts Institute. We thank our supporters for seasons 1 to 10, who include founding sponsor American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst, inaugural sponsor Studio Haslund, and sponsor Scan Design Foundation. We are additionally grateful to Scandinavian Airlines for featuring select episodes on their in-flight programming on long-haul flights. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next week.